This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Undammed rivers and streams in their natural states are free to move. They sometimes spread out beyond their banks, and they occasionally or even regularly flood. This wild, seemingly unpredictable behavior is healthy for rivers, and it keeps the fish and birds and amphibians and even the people who need the river healthy. A lot of our rivers here in Utah and throughout the West are not wild, and many are not healthy. They've been dammed to store water or to make electricity. They've been funneled through culverts and forced underground so we can drive over them. They've been left exposed to grazing cattle that trample and erode their banks. When rivers are restricted or channelized, they start to cut deeper and deeper into the earth. They don't spread out. They don't flood. They're controlled for various purposes, but they're not healthy. Wildlife biologists and geologists who study rivers and streams are tasked with making rivers healthy again by letting them return to their natural, wild, and messy state. They've enlisted the help of experts, rodent experts, to help with the job. Ross Chambliss has this story about what beavers do so well and how we can learn from them.
Joe Wheaton has taken me to the edge of a stream called Temple Fork here in the headwaters of the Logan River. Wheaton is a fluvial geomorphologist at Utah State University. That means he basically studies how water shapes and changes the land. Wheaton says this riparian area was badly damaged from many years of unchecked cattle grazing and reckless campers, but he wants me to see what beavers have since done here.
This is on the main stem here of Temple Fork. In 2009, there was nothing here all the way up to the fall. Over a period of probably 2 to 3 weeks, we think. So they built that first draft of the dam, and then the next fall they came back and then raised it up to its elevation here, which spread water all the way out, all around over there. And then that dam sort of persisted. It didn't breach even in the 2011 floods. It's been around ever since, but last year, we're not sure exactly when, but somebody came and just shot him.
Just shot him, he says. Murdered him. Beavers get killed a lot, Wheaton says, just for, well, being beavers. I can see the pained frustration in his face. This same dam-building rodent that he's enamored with is also vilified by some who see the buck-toothed mammal as a pest. And it's true, beavers cut down lots of trees. They can also build dams that flood roads and property. Sometimes farmers and ranchers even think beavers steal their water.
Well, it's an unfortunate name that we give these things and call them dams, because as humans, we think of dams as these big impermeable water storage, you know, facilities. And with a beaver dam, if you walk back and look at that, or you just walk back and listen to it, it's a porous mess, right? And so this is a big leaky sponge. And so what really happens here is, you know, a better way to think of it is, if you want to think of it as a reservoir more like your snowpack, is you get a bunch of water storage here, and then you get the slow release of that water over time. So beaver can't create water or destroy water or take water away. They don't drink that much. But what they can do is create these temporary storage, you know, sort of zones that then slowly release that out over time. So if you're an irrigator downstream, and it's really important to you to have a lot of water in, say, May or June, when you already have a lot of water, then maybe this is a problem. But if you're an irrigator that maybe wants water when it's getting really hot in August or September, this might actually help.
Beavers build dams that are temporary. Eventually, all beaver dams get abandoned or blown out or sometimes blown up with dynamite. But Wheaton says what matters most is what the dams leave behind. Beaver dams capture sediment that creates complicated habitat, often ideal for amphibians, fish, and countless other creatures that depend on healthy streams.
But there's a big misconception with the deposits in these dams that, you know, they're just filled with nothing but the fine sediment. And that is good that beaver dams could be a sink for that fine sediment that may be a water quality problem. But if you look at just what we see right here, I mean, there's actually, those look like gorgeous spawning gravels in there if you're, say, a cutthroat trout. And we also see a lot of organics and wood mixed in. Some of that's the material that they've used in the winter to build up their food cache. So they'll actually sort of put sticks on the bottom, let them get waterlogged, and then that's what will sustain them as this freezes over in the winter. They can harvest that material that they stored up in the fall in a food cache. And so these deposits have a lot more mixed, you know, they're not just fines, they're coarse material like gravels and this wood. And so when this dam goes away, this isn't just this big source now of sediment that is going to be released. It's this much more complex deposit that leaves behind it much more complicated habitat. And a lot of this stuff stays here, and it slowly builds up these valleys. And a lot of the valleys that we see in these small little tributaries, the valley bottoms themselves are largely a product of beaver dams over time, just building these surfaces up.
Wow.
As Wheaton explains these things, I'm beginning to understand his enthusiasm, his passion about beavers and the dams they build. These tiny creatures are actually capable of repairing the ecosystems of whole entire river valleys. We're with some of his research colleagues, and with our fishing waders strapped on, we're walking further up to Spawn Creek, another tributary that's a protected spawning stream for native cutthroat trout. About 10 years ago, the U.S. Forest Service decided to protect this area after overgrazing from cattle had eroded stream banks so much that fish populations were dwindling. Since then, with the cattle kept out and the beavers left alone to build their dams, the fish populations have flourished. Wheaton says this place perfectly illustrates how beavers can help restore damaged streams across the West. That's why he's helped to develop a Beaver Restoration Assessment Tool, or BRAT for short, that is now helping to predict where beavers will likely build dams on streams across the whole state of Utah. Wheaton says his own conversion to beaver believer came from witnessing the futility of some conventional restoration projects.
I got involved initially just in stuff that was essentially stream bank stabilization to protect private property that was being called restoration.
And what's involved with that? Kind of
basically trying to stabilize banks, but then instead of maybe doing it with riprap, they'd do it with more natural, you know, materials, you know, so you might use sort of erosion control blankets and lay the banks back and that sort of stuff, or you might just try and get the banks planted with a bunch of riparian veg. Then we were doing a lot of what was called spawning habitat restoration, downstream of dams. So not beaver dams, but big, huge water reservoirs. They not only hold back water, they also block the delivery of sediment from the upper watershed. And so not all sediment's bad. Mm. If you're a salmonid, you need nice, clean spawning gravels to spawn in. And so those gravels are also locked up behind these dams. And so what people would do is they would dump gravel back downstream of the dam. And so we came up with a bunch of ways to, instead of just dumping it and hoping it sort of reformed and good habitat, where we'd actually build spawning habitat.
I see.
And so this is all what I like to call Tonka toy restoration. So where we, you know, with all our confidence and engineering arrogance, we go out and we think, yep, we know what's best for the river, and we're going to go and fix this and try and make it better.
Uh-huh. And you say Tonka toy because a lot of it involves large machinery.
Yeah, it's all with so. With this, it was, you know, using front-end loaders and excavators and whatnot to place material in the channel. In a lot of cases, people are using those same sort of Tonka toys to even build new channels. And so you have maybe a straight and sort of degraded channel, and then they'll go, you know, build a perfect sine curve or something and a nice little meandering channel off the side. There's been a lot of criticism by restoration scientists of those sorts of approaches as being too prescriptive, too form mimicry, and instead wanting to let the river do the work and let natural processes sort of shape the river. And you're much better in the long term if you can come up with a restoration strategy that relies less on us and our judgment and more on the river sort of building the habitat.
Across Utah, the state's Division of Wildlife Resources spends millions of dollars each year on what Wheaton would call Tonka toy restoration. Aside from being expensive, the big problem that Wheaton sees is that few restoration projects receive much follow-up or monitoring after a project is finished to verify whether the efforts are truly making streams healthier.
Well, to a certain degree, that's correct. We are having a hard time coming up with a metric to actually monitor. I mean, because we're in the business of fish management for the most part.
This is Kent Sorensen.
Okay, I'm Kent Sorensen. I'm currently working in the Division of Wildlife Resources Northern Region as the assistant habitat manager, which basically entails a lot of riparian restoration work.
Currently, the DWR say they are working with federal, state, and other local partners on over 50 stream restoration projects statewide.
And as a division, we're really good at doing. We can grab money, make a project, do a project, but our constituency base kind of expects us to go on to the next one and do another one and do another one. They're not as concerned about, did what you do make a difference? Because they see a difference. It's manifested in this hole where I never used to be able to catch fish, now I can catch fish. So they're satisfied with a change. Now, whether that change is significant or not, we don't get a chance to go back and look because we're on to the next project.
As Sorensen alludes to, the state mainly looks at fish habitat for gauging a healthy stream. For example, the stated mission of the division's Blue Ribbon Fisheries Advisory Council works to improve Utah's streams for the enjoyment of anglers. They spend over $250,000 a year on stream restoration work. About one-fifth of that goes towards monitoring. And they say the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Division of Water Quality, and the Environmental Protection Agency are increasingly requiring more in-depth and long-term assessments in the future. Still, Sorensen concedes that the metric of only keeping anglers happy may be too myopic for understanding the overall health of most streams.
When you do the heavy equipment types of restoration, it's satisfying in one way because you can walk away at the end of the week and say, look, I've changed this river course, I've made better habitat, and now we're on to the next one. Well, what you don't know is if you really did any good. It appears that you might have done some good, but you may not have. But, you know, we're learning, and some of the things we've done, I'm pretty confident that we've hit a home run on. Some of the things we've done, I'm pretty confident we, you know, need to go back to the drawing board.
So you're probably asking, what does any of this have to do with beavers? Well, a few years ago, Utah DWR produced one of the most progressive beaver management plans in the West. The same agency that for decades commonly turned to lethal removal to deal with beavers now treats the animal as a valued tool for stream restoration. Sorensen says beavers and their tonka toys are just different tools in the same box.
You know, high water can sometimes cause, you know, obvious damage to a river course, and we're expected to address that. The heavy equipment approach is probably more appropriate there. It's a spot approach. It doesn't really have a lot of linear mileage to it that you can actually do with the types of budgets we get to work with. And it's quickly available to address a problem, a discrete problem. So yes, we still do that. But now you get into an area that's a more of a headwater type of a situation where it's not appropriate to bring heavy equipment in. It's either a long ways away from a population center, it's in a low conflict area for beaver, and get them in an area where they can excel at what they do, then they're completely appropriate. They address those incision problems that our rivers have. They bring the grade back up by trapping the sediment behind their dams. They work 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. They don't need a Corps of Engineers 404 permit. They just do your job for you.
Still, pretty much everyone agrees beavers work best in the headwaters, high in the mountains, far away from where people live and travel. Again, here's Joe Wheaton.
So it's going to be probably smaller systems, like these tributaries that we're up in, where they can actually build dams. And so and oftentimes that's going to correspond with a lot of these areas that are, you know, whether they're managed by the Forest Service or BLM or whatnot, that are higher up in the system. And there are certainly places lower down, and valleys, but it's oftentimes there's more potential for sort of conflict with other land uses. And so, you know, beaver may cut down trees you don't want them to cut down, or they may clog culverts, or they may cause flooding. And so it's not to say that they can't be used as a restoration agent in those situations, but just requires a bit more planning and careful thinking, whereas up here, you know, there are certainly situations where it really can be as simple as just either letting them recover on their own or just bringing beaver back to a stream that doesn't have beaver right now.
So it's in places like this, the headwaters of the Logan River, where Wheaton thinks there's wisdom in leaving the dam building to the beavers, what he calls process-based restoration. He hopes this approach to stream restoration will catch on, and in the long run will result in streams that are healthy not just for fish, but indeed for the entire biota of our rivers. For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
Ross did some hiking and got to wear waders for his beaver story. My beaver assignment was a little less adventurous.
Really good quality beaver habitat for, you know, thousands of years.
There's like five grocery carts.
I head to the wetlands in the Walmart parking lot when The Source continues.